This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
As well as Ernesto Media on Twitter. Where else can you lend a big hand and not even have to leave the house or even get dressed up? Program evaluations for KPFT are fun and easy, so help us out today. This is KPFT Houston.
Did you know you can find KPFT on the social networking sites MySpace and Facebook? You certainly can, and we'd love you to add us as a friend and get us connected with friends of yours. On Facebook, for example, you can connect to KPFT as a friend, join our fan page, and check out a special video message from General Manager Dwayne Bradley to Facebook users, as well as keep up with KPFT programmers and staff. Visit Facebook.com/KPFT Houston to join us. On MySpace, KPFT provides event videos, updates, and a lot more. Visit MySpace.com/KPFT Houston to add KPFT as a friend. It's fun, so catch up with KPFT online. Again, on MySpace, visit MySpace.com/KPFT Houston. On Facebook, visit us at Facebook.com/KPFT Houston. This is commercial-free, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio and KPFT Houston.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender community. This is Queer Voices.
Good evening. This is Jack Valinsky.
And Jennifer Renee.
Brian Levinka.
And Summer Iman.
And Glenn Holt. And on tonight's show, can Obama save his presidency? And if so, what is his path to saving it? And don't ask, don't tell. He promised in his State of the Union address to abolish it. First up this evening, our Washington correspondent, David Elliott. Then followed by news wrap from This Way Out. In tonight's summary of GLBT News, the Hawaii State House has killed a civil unions bill passed last week by that state's Senate. And the Indiana State Senate has passed a constitutional ban on same-gender marriage and civil unions. In Mexico, federal prosecutors have announced that they will challenge Mexico City's marriage and adoptions equality law in Mexico's Supreme Court. Then at 9:40 p.m., previously thought to be the unmentionable disease in public forums, the little-known disease of anal cancer, has been brought to light by the recent arrival of a vaccine against the human papillomavirus, otherwise known as HPV. Rice University will be holding a special lecture on the subject this coming Friday, and Brian Riedel will give us a preview. Then Miss Perfect has launched her search for a man who has what it takes to become Mr. Perfect. At 10 o'clock, we'll look at the 2010 Miss and Mr. Perfect pageant. This year's theme is Fabulous in Faux Fur. And pageant producer Paul Hidalgo will join us to discuss the event. It's coming up this Saturday evening. At 10:22, we have a discussion of the latest information on the recent murder of a transgender woman in Houston and other transgender issues. The director of Houston Transgender Foundation of America, Kristen Williams, will join us. Followed at 10:40 by the feature segments from This Way Out tonight, looking at President Barack Obama's vow to end the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy on GLBT military personnel, and a look at some of the backstory to the movie Brokeback Mountain. So a very busy show tonight.
Right, and before we get to that, there's a couple of things I want to just mention. First of all is the passing of Elroy W. Forbes. Elroy was a very much involved person in probably the earlier part of this movement in the community. Elroy did a lot of work in doing publicity. He was very much involved in the band for a number of years, and I have to give him a personal thanks for doing the first in the long history of Pride Guide starting in 1987. Probably the most disorganized person in the world, but probably the most caring and wanting person to make this much better community, not just the GLBT community, but he also was, I guess you call it, the king of the Renaissance Festival.
I would say that.
He did that for a number of years. He also was probably played the best Santa Claus ever in not only this community, but so many people did know him, and he's an icon that will surely be missed. At the River Oaks Theater, there's a film playing called A Single Man with Colin Firth and Julianne Moore. It is a story about a college professor in the 60s who happens to be gay and dealing with the loss of his longtime partner and how difficult it was back then. I really would recommend seeing this movie.
It was very good. I saw it.
Absolutely wonderful movie. Of course, playing at our favorite theater, the River Oaks. This coming Wednesday is a caucus endorsement meeting for non-judicial candidates. They already had their meetings for endorsing judicial candidates. That will be at the Haven Center on West Alabama starting at 7 p.m. Go to thecaucus.org. And I also want to talk about creating change. It's happening this week up in Dallas, starting on February 3rd. I guess it's tomorrow, right?
Mm-hmm.
Through the 7th.
That would be Wednesday.
No. Wednesday,
okay. It is a wonderful conference. I think they've already got about 2,200 people, if not more, registered. And, in fact, David Elliott used to work for the National, the GOB, the Creating Change is done by NGLTF, National Gay Lesbian Task Force, and I know David was involved with that for a while. It's here in Texas. It's a wonderful conference, and it talks about so many different issues, so if you have a chance to go up there and do it, our friend Tim Brookover is going to be there, so we'll have him on the show to give us a report. So, let's go to David Elliott.
David, welcome.
Well, thank you, Jack, and thank you, Jennifer. I apologize. I think I had a bit of a technical mishap there. These iPhones aren't really all what they're cracked up to be.
Well, what have you got for us on Obama? Can he save his presidency?
Well, let's start off, if I can, with breaking news from Washington, D.C. tonight.
Okay.
Something that a lot of us have been waiting a long time to hear. Some really good news, I think. You and Jennifer, Jack, we know that in 2008, candidate Barack Obama campaigned on the promise that he would repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And then again, he repeated that promise at a gay pride event at the White House last June. He repeated it again when the Human Rights Campaign held a major fundraising dinner in Washington, D.C. last October. And he was clearly unambiguous when he said in front of the entire nation last Wednesday during the State of the Union address, quote, "This year, I will work with Congress and our military to finally repeal the law that denies gay Americans the right to serve the country they love because of who they are. It is the right thing to do." And so now, tomorrow, for the first time in 17 years, a Senate committee, the Senate Armed Forces Committee, is going to have a hearing on Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And that's not all, and that's not even the biggest news. The biggest news is that we expect the White House to issue a what's called a stopgap order to immediately stop the practice of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. In other words, even though it is going to take Congress perhaps a year, who knows how long, to pass, you know, the law repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell, the Obama administration, the military, through executive power, will apparently stop this once and for all. This policy, which, by the way, has resulted in nearly 14,000 people being kicked out of the armed forces at a time when we're fighting two wars, one in Iraq and one in Afghanistan. So that's the great news that I have to begin with. A promise made, a promise about to be kept.
That's great news. Well, I heard that in the State of the Union address, but I didn't know that he was actually taking action immediately on it.
Well, and Jennifer, you know what? I'm not going to ascribe the recent poll numbers only to that, but I do want to point out a couple of things. Last Wednesday, President Obama gave his State of the Union, and then on Friday, President Obama went to visit with the House Republicans. They were having a little retreat in Baltimore, Maryland, and he stood up to them, and he parried with them. He argued with them, and it was on TV. And at the same time, the Republican National Committee had flown off to Hawaii and was having their annual meeting in Hawaii and was discussing their 2010 campaign strategy and how they were going to use populist themes. They were discussing this out in Hawaii to run against Democrats. And since that time, depending on which poll you look at, Obama has gone up either 4 points or 13 points in a period of 4 days. The polling the last 4 or 5 days, for whatever reason, was it because of the State of the Union? Was it because of his encounter with the Republicans? Was it because of the Republicans going out to Hawaii for their meeting? Who knows? But Obama has shot up in the polls. But I have to tell you, there are a couple of things, and I want to mention four of them, that Obama and the Democrats are going to have to do to be successful in 2010. And, you know, first, we have to kind of look at history, okay? With few exceptions, the first off-year election in a new president's term has led to big gains for the minority party. You know, this time it would be for the Republicans.
Yeah,
I mean, that was true for Harry Truman. It was true for Dwight Eisenhower. It was true for Ronald Reagan. It was true for Bill Clinton. So Democrats, I mean, historically, are going to lose some seats in the House and the Senate this time around. But, you know, it is important to remember that in 2006 and 2008, voters did send an unmistakable message to Washington, D.C. They said they wanted decisive change. They said they wanted a government that looks out for Main Street, not for Wall Street. They said they wanted a government that works for the people, not for the entitled, not for the special interests. They said they wanted a government that works for them, a government that plays the role it should to help the security of the middle class. Now, what are the four things that the Democrats and the Obama administration need to do to save this presidency? Number one, they have to pass meaningful health care reform, and they have to do it without delay. They need to do it in the next 3 or 4 months. Number two, they need to demonstrate that they just don't care about jobs. They just don't feel Americans' pain on jobs. They also want to create jobs, and they're moving toward creating jobs. And, you know, I have to say, right now, the unemployment rate is about 10.1%. We are expecting it to go to about 10.8% by the end of September. And that's if nothing is done. So it's not a pretty picture that we're looking at there. The third thing that Democrats need to do is, and the Obama administration needs to do, is they need to explain to Americans what the stimulus package we passed last year really did. People don't understand that we saved 1.8 million jobs with that package. In Houston, there would be a lot of school teachers, firefighters, police officers, other government workers who would be laid off right now if that thing hadn't passed. We're talking about 1.8 million. We're talking about if it hadn't passed, the unemployment rate would have already been at 10.8% in this country. And that's kind of hard for people to get their arms around. The fourth thing, and this is kind of tricky, but the fourth thing that Obama and the Democrats have to do in order to win next November, or to, you know, minimize what would historically be modest losses, is we have to let Republicans be Republicans. Right now, there is an internal battle royale that is going on within the Republican Party. They are fighting each other like you wouldn't believe. I mean, take John McCain. He was the Republican Party standard bearer 2 years ago. He was the Republican nominee. And now, as a U.S. Senator, he has a fiercely contested primary race. He's got a former member of Congress running against him, and a lot of people he want to see him defeated. And in about 12 House and Senate races across the country, you have members of the so-called Tea Party running against incumbent Republicans. They can't really figure out whether they want to be kind of moderate, economic, country club Republicans, or if they want to be hard right, anti-gay, anti-choice, anti-immigrant Republicans. And they're going to have to figure that out. If they decide they want to go to the hard right, they're going to lose the independents. If they decide that they want to go toward the independents, you know, the sort of moderate country club, soft, you know, touchy-feely route, they're going to lose the Tea Party backers. Either way, they've got their work cut out for them. So, in conclusion, even though it seems like this might be somewhat tough times for the Democrats, and it is, and the Democrats have their challenges, and the Obama administration has its challenges, all is not lost. And we have a lot of things to look forward to as we move on to the year, and it's going to be a really interesting election cycle, and I can't wait.
Well, it's going to be exciting no matter what happens.
That's right, and there's an incredible primary coming up in Texas.
Oh, yes.
You've got Perry versus Hutchinson, and all of a sudden, you've got your Tea Party candidate who has no money whatsoever, and she's going from 2% in the polls to 15%.
Well, you know, David, that was rather interesting because she was on the there's been two statewide televised debates, and because she was on the first one, her numbers went way up, and then she was on the second one last Friday. But she's a really interesting character.
A very interesting. You know, I couldn't believe they asked her, you know, how much money does the average school teacher in Texas make? And they looked at her, and she just shot back, oh, $41,000. And she was, like, within, you know, $400 or $500 of being
asked.
Yes, accurate.
That was interesting. But, you know.
But then, on the other hand, you know, she's talking about eliminating property taxes in Texas, and Texas
yes.
already doesn't have the state income tax. So basically, to fund state government, you would have to institute a sales tax in the neighborhood of 16% to 18%, which would just be completely insane.
Yes, and I kind of doubt that would be enough because it's already 8.25% here in Houston.
Right. Well. Right. And. Yeah, I mean, you'd have economic carnage. You'd have a situation worse than California. And does Texas really, really want to be like California? But at the same time, you know, I don't want to be speaking against her because that might sound like I'm speaking in favor of Perry or Hutchinson. But, you know,
we know you would never do that.
Although I did play against Kate Bailey Hutchinson in a softball game once.
Ah, okay. But we have some really unique. We've got our mayor, our previous mayor, is running for governor on the Democratic side, and I can't pronounce the other Democrat.
Farouk.
Shami. Farouk Shami. And they're both very interesting. One's a billionaire business person, which almost sounds Republican, and a good, solid leader, administrator of a city. So that's going to be an interesting one, too.
Well, Bill White is, you know, raising a lot of money. I don't think I've betraying anybody to say that, you know, everybody expects him to be the Democratic nominee, you know, just because of, you know, he's going to be able to, you know, fund his field operation and his DOTV and his ad, you know, every metropolitan area. And I think it's going to be an interesting race this November in Texas. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. And of course, there are a number, you know, the Republicans are like two seats ahead of the Democrats in the state House. And of course, this is the legislature that will help redraw the district maps for after the census.
And that's, Jack, that is actually kind of scary.
Yes.
And, you know, everybody needs to be encouraging, you know, the folks to get out because, frankly, at a state legislative level, I mean, in Texas and all across the country, we're probably going to be looking at significant losses this year.
Yes. Yes. Well, on that note,
Happy New Year, by the way.
Well, I hope it's not going to be that bad. The Massachusetts thing was so scary, and that shouldn't have been a lost cause, but it is really scary.
Well, the move toward change in Texas may still move despite what the rest of the country does.
Sure, and Texas, I know that y'all are feeling it down there, and I don't want to minimize it at all, but the unemployment numbers in Texas aren't as bad as they are in like 35 or 40 states across the country. Some of the states, I mean, I'm looking at the Michigan numbers and the Rhode Island numbers and Nevada and California and Florida. And, I mean, it's just, it almost makes me cry. I mean, and the fact that we've basically doubled the unemployment rate since 2007. And well, we'll have since, you know, when we get to September. Because it is going to go up, including Texas, by about another 1.5%.
Well, David, we'll be talking to you next month, the day before the primary here in Texas.
Jack, that's going to be exciting. I'm going to be looking forward to that.
Okay. So, David, tell us what you're doing for your day job.
Well, right now I'm helping run a massive coalition called the Jobs for America Now Coalition. I am the communications director for a group called U.S. Action. Our website is at usaction.org, and thank you for having me.
Well, David Elliott joins us the first Monday of every month and gives us sort of a national perspective of what's going on in Washington, D.C. And, David, we will talk to you next month. You're listening to Queer Voices.
The hearts and minds of the world go out to those impacted by the devastation in Haiti. KPFT, your community radio station, encourages you to do what you can to support efforts to help others in the wake of this tragedy. Around the world, people like you are lending assistance. For example, Partners in Health, an international organization providing health care for the poor, is seeking contributions for medical help for Haitians. Visit standwithhaiti.com to learn more about how you can help. Please stay tuned for ongoing coverage of the crisis in Haiti right here on 90.1 KPFT, including on the BBC News at 7 a.m., on Democracy Now! At 8, and Free Speech Radio News at 4 p.m. Keep listening to KPFT to learn more about aid organizations and how you can support them, and the radio station that provides you up-to-the-minute coverage. Keep the people of Haiti in your thoughts. Thank you for listening to KPFT Houston.
This is Queer Voices.
And this is Jennifer Renee.
And Jack Falinski. And Rich Ehrenschild has brought us a guest here. And Rich, since this was your idea, why don't you sort of do this interview.
I'll be happy to. You know I'm not shy. It's nice to be here. Thanks again.
Yeah, thank you for coming. There's a big Valentine Romeo and Juliet performance.
Yes, and we have as a special guest Antoine Plant, who is the artistic director for Mercury Baroque. And this Valentine's Day endeavor is a co-production between Mercury Baroque, who's providing the music, and Dominic Walsh Dance Theater. Many of you might know Dominic from his 17-year tenure at the ballet. The interesting thing about this particular Valentine's Day performance is that there's a very special GLBT reception following the performance for Queer Voices listeners, for Outsmart readers, and for members of the GLBT community who have an interest in finding more out about Dominic Walsh Dance Theater and Mercury Baroque. So, Antoine, why don't you tell us a little bit about the music and just a little bit about the show?
Yeah, sure. Well, this is a co-production. So basically, it's a reprise. 5 years ago, Dominic and I got together, and he wanted to do that great story of Romeo and Juliet, but he wanted to do it in a new way. And so he asked me to look at creating a score to give the story. And he wanted to have, of course, dancers to do the story, but also he wanted to have actors for some of the intricate part that was just done better with the voice. And we have opera singers as well on stage. So it's a really multicultural activity here, and it's a really, really cool show.
Good. And for those of us that have seen other kind of more traditional, read boring versions of the show, this has a bit of an edge, and the music, there's a lot of passion in the music and the action. So talk a little bit about that.
That's right. Well, we choose that we would go with Vivaldi, so music from the Baroque era, which is my specialty. And I've listened to, last time I looked in my iTunes, I had 94 CDs of Vivaldi. So I went through the whole thing and choose. One of the great things about Vivaldi is that it's such emotional and dramatic music. So really got the most beautiful and lyrical pieces for, you know, the love scenes and the death scenes and things like that. But also, as I say, you know, we have opera singers. We also have a chorus. The Bach Society chorus is there. And we have, you know, for the big scene, the wedding scene and the end, we have beautiful chorus movements pure orchestral pieces that really accompany the story, gives it a special spring, and really gave a great inspiration to Dominic to create that ballet.
Terrific. And for those of you who don't know, Dominic Walsh has been at kind of a fixture in the dance community, and he's also been out. He's an out choreographer, and he doesn't shy away from that, and his work is really different and new and beautiful. There's an article in this month's Outsmart magazine with a exquisite picture on the front of one of the pas de deux from the ballet. I'd like to talk just a little bit about Mercury Baroque and Dominic Walsh Dance Theater honoring the gay community with the reception. And I think there's a couple things that are happening here. I think arts organizations throughout the city have kind of finally realized that the GLBT community comprises a pretty large percentage of their audience. You see this really from the Alley does it, the Houston Grand Opera does it, the Ballet does it. I don't know if the Symphony does it. And I think it's very interesting that these two organizations have kind of realized that as well. So I think, talk a little bit about the benefits of that kind of community following the performance.
Well, for our arts organization, but especially a little smaller arts organizations like Dominic's and mine, it's really important to be part of the community and to meet the people. We want to hear back. We want to meet people. We want to be relevant to this community. That's what we are. So, to offer a way for the artists to meet the community is a really, really great tool. And we do it in all sorts of different venue. This is great because, well, it happens on Valentine's Day and mm-hmm. it's the Torre Vermiglioletto, of course. And after the show, we have a special reception for the community, and we'll have a lot of artists there, and we have nice food, nice wine, and all that at no cost. And it's just a good way for us to be there for our community.
And you'll be there as well, right?
Absolutely.
So they'll get you can get free conducting lessons and maybe some fencing lessons for those of you that have some interest in fencing.
Yeah, there's great fencing actually. The fencing is there in the show. There's a great fencing moment. But anyway, these things are really a way so that the art is not just one way. It really is a communication between
Excellent.
Us and our
That's
audience.
Great.
So give us the who, what, when, where, why.
The Who is Dominic Walsh Dance Theater and Mercury Baroque in this co-production, which is a reprisal of something they did a few years back very successfully. It's Romeo and Juliet. It's production that we're kind of encouraging people to go to is the Valentine's Day production at 2 p.m. at Wortham Theater Center. And with a reception following in the very swanky green room with some chocolate and sweets. For information, you can contact Mercury Baroque at 713-533-0080. Or for tickets, you can call 832-251-0706. Or you can visit Mercury Baroque on the web at www.mercurybaroque.org.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And you're listening to Queer Voices.
I'm Chris Wilson.
And I'm John Torrance.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news intersecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending January 30th, 2010. Testimony concluded this week in the closely watched U.S. federal court trial challenging the constitutionality of California's Proposition 8. High-profile attorneys Theodore Olson and David Boies are representing two plaintiff couples, one lesbian and one gay, who were denied marriage licenses after California voters overturned the state Supreme Court's May 2008 marriage equality ruling at the ballot box 6 months later. Attorneys for a coalition of religious and conservative groups who sponsored Proposition 8 are defending the measure because, in a somewhat unusual move, California's Attorney General Jerry Brown has refused to do so. Chief U.S. District Judge Vaughn Walker is hearing the non-jury case, known as Perry v. Schwarzenegger, in San Francisco.
The plaintiffs rested their case early in the day on January 25th, by showing videotape of a simulcast in which supporters of Proposition 8 claimed that same-gender marriage would lead to polygamy and bestiality. It was in support of one of their central arguments that Proposition 8 was a product of anti-gay bias and served no legitimate public interest. The footage concluded almost 2 weeks of testimony about the changing cultural meaning of marriage, the nature of sexual orientation, and the role of religion in shaping attitudes toward both.
Among more than a dozen witnesses were the official plaintiffs, Kristen Perry and Sandra Steer, a lesbian couple from Berkeley, and Paul Katami and Jeffrey Zerillo, a gay couple from Burbank, Republican San Diego Mayor Jerry Sanders in support of his lesbian daughter, a hostile witness, Prop 8 supporter, and several social scientists and legal scholars. They included Stanford University political science professor Dr. Gary Gagura, who testified last week that his research showed that the incremental legal victories won by LGBT people in recent years do not equate to their having attained substantial political power.
Claremont McKenna College political science professor Dr. Kenneth Miller was called as the first defense witness on January 25th to rebut that assertion. The defense insisted during the trial that lesbians and gay men are not a disadvantaged minority who deserve constitutional protections. Miller testified that gays and lesbians have gained increasingly persuasive power in American politics, but he could only point to recent federal LGBT inclusive hate crimes legislation, which took 9 years to get passed, and President Barack Obama's pro-gay statements. During cross-examination by plaintiff attorney David Boies that carried into the next day, Miller admitted that he was either unfamiliar with or hadn't read the work of many leading experts on the issue, some of whom had testified earlier in the trial. He also agreed that gays and lesbians face discrimination in the workplace and that it was correct to characterize laws banning military service by open gays and lesbians and refusing to recognize same-gender couples as examples of legally enforced discrimination. But he called Proposition 8 differential treatment. Whether it's legally discriminatory, he said, I don't know. Boies also grilled Miller on his past academic writings, which included sharp criticism of the initiative process under which Proposition 8 became law as unfiltered direct democratic rule.
David Blankenhorn, president of the Institute for American Values, a New York-based conservative think tank, then took the stand later on January 26 as a second witness for the defense. He acknowledged that heterosexuals were responsible for rising divorce and out-of-wedlock birth rates, but said that opening marriage to lesbian and gay couples could accelerate that process and possibly lead to the legalization of polygamy. He said rights for same-gender couples are secondary to the importance of preserving traditional marriage. But during sometimes contentious cross-examination by plaintiff attorney David Boies that continued into the following day, Blankenhorn admitted that he has conducted no independent research on same-gender marriage and that his only advanced degree is in comparative labor history. I have read articles and had conversations with people and tried to be an informed person about it, he said, and that really has been the extent of it. He testified that research shows that being raised by biological heterosexual parents in a stable marriage produces the most well-adjusted children. But under cross-examination, he said that he was unaware of any studies showing that children fared worse when raised by lesbian or gay parents, and admitted that allowing same-gender couples to legally marry would be likely to improve the well-being of gay and lesbian households and their children.
The defense then rested its case on January 27th after a total of two witnesses and less than 3 days of testimony. Judge Walker came down from the bench and congratulated the attorneys for each side on what a good job you've both done. He said he wanted to review all the testimony and evidence that had been presented during the 12 days of the trial, which will probably take him several weeks before he hears closing arguments. Walker has no deadline for issuing a ruling, which will almost certainly be appealed, eventually reaching the U.S. Supreme Court.
Elsewhere, the Hawaii State House on January 29th indefinitely postponed a vote on a civil unions bill for same-gender couples. The simple voice vote effectively killed consideration of the measure during the current legislative session. The state Senate had already approved the bill, but even if it had passed in both chambers, Republican Governor Linda Lingle, who had not stated her position on the measure, may not have signed it. Civil union supporters in the crowded House gallery shouted, "Shame on you," while opponents cheered. No roll call was taken on the decision to postpone the vote, which protected representatives from having their position on the record during this election year.
The Indiana State Senate approved a constitutional amendment to ban same-gender marriages this week. The 38-10 vote in the Republican-controlled chamber marked the fourth time it has approved such a measure, which this year added a ban on civil unions as well. Indiana law already bans same-gender marriages, and the leader of the Democratic-controlled state House says the measure is unlikely to get a hearing there. A constitutional amendment in Indiana must be approved by two separately elected legislatures before going to the voters for final consideration.
Federal prosecutors announced this week that they would try to overturn Mexico City's marriage equality law, which was approved in December, and also allows same-gender couples to adopt children. Mexico's Roman Catholic Church has harshly criticized the law. It was also strongly opposed by President Felipe Calderón's conservative National Action Party. His Attorney General, Arturo Chavez, said that his office will file an appeal with the country's Supreme Court, arguing that the law violates the principle of legality because it strays from the constitutional principle of protecting the family, and that it strays from the responsibility of the government to place a priority on safeguarding the interests of children. Mexico City Mayor Marcelo Ebrard said that nothing in the country's constitution prohibits marriage or adoption by same-gender couples. The city's legal advisor, Leticia Bonifaz, told reporters that the first marriages will be performed in early May, probably while the Supreme Court is hearing the case. The federal prosecutor's office previously challenged a Mexico City law legalizing abortion, but the Supreme Court upheld that measure in 2008.
The Moscow City Court has upheld a lower court decision supporting the city's refusal to give a marriage license to a lesbian couple. Irina Fedotova-Fett and Irina Shipitko, who later traveled to Canada and got married, said they would appeal the case to the European Court of Human Rights. They'll also demand that Russia recognize their Canadian marriage as soon as they receive their marriage certificate from Toronto.
Another lawsuit at the European Court of Human Rights, filed several months ago by the organizers of Moscow Pride, challenges Mayor Yuri Lushkov's repeated bans of their events. The case has been delayed because Russian officials said they were too busy to file a government response in a timely fashion. The court extended the deadline to February 20th. Chief Moscow Pride organizer Nikolai Alexeyev denounced the development, saying it took far too long for the Eurocourt to accept the case in the first place. He accused the Russian government of engaging in what he characterized as stalling tactics. Alexeyev said the delay makes it very unlikely that there will be a decision in the case prior to his group's fifth annual attempt to stage a Pride gathering on May 29th. Lushkov has banned organized LGBT events in each of the past 4 years and has sent riot police to violently arrest small groups of activists who ignored the bans. The mayor has repeatedly called Pride events satanic and, according to some reports, weapons of mass destruction. He called Pride demonstrations blasphemy this week during remarks to an education conference, vowing to again stop this year's planned events and bring to bear on them the full force and justice of the law.
And finally, more than 1,300 U.S. gays and lesbians have demonstrated just how satanic they are in response to the horrible earthquake in Haiti, which televangelist Pat Robertson blamed on its people having made a deal with the devil to gain their freedom in 1804 during a slave rebellion against French colonial rule. According to a press release issued this week by the American Red Cross, its LGBT Haiti Relief Fund has already raised more money than many of the huge corporate donors. This was accomplished by significant outreach efforts to the LGBT community via donors and activists, the statement continued, along with a massive email campaign to the members of three LGBT cruise companies, Olivia, Atlantis, and RSVP. Within a week, the community had raised over $150,000.
That's News Wrap for the week ending January 30th, 2010. Written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. You can read the text of this week's News Wrap online at www.thiswayout.org.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm John Torres.
And I'm Chris Wilson.
This is Queer Voices.
And this is Brian Levinka.
And Jennifer Renee.
And in the gay community, there's a lot of talk about HIV and AIDS, but a lot of talk is not given to HPV, which is the human papilloma virus. A lot of talk is with women, but there's a forum at esteemed Rice University this Friday, and friend of the show, Brian Riedel, is on tonight to discuss this upcoming forum. Welcome, Brian.
It's great to be back, Brian. Jennifer, good to see you all.
Good to see you, too.
So
this is incredibly interesting because I was talking just before we went on the air that I didn't realize that the vaccine for the virus is actually can be used to help men.
Mm-hmm. Gardasil does not care about the body into which it's injected. It just cares about those particular forms of the human papillomavirus that it likes to interfere with. So
that's good news that we have a virus that has a cure, so to speak.
Well, for many of the viruses that make up the big body, just like HIV, has lots of clades and different kinds, so does HPV, and Gardasil is only good against a few of them.
So why isn't this spoken about in society? I mean, what's the big deal?
Well, it's interesting because a lot of oxygen in the sexual transmitted infection awareness world has been sucked up by infections like HIV. HPV gets a lower rating on the radar screen, according to some people. But recently, Texas had a big kerfuffle with George Perry. I'm fusing some of these names together. Yes. George Bush and a little Governor Perry.
That's an unholy alliance.
Sorry about that. Yeah. So Perry had a little kerfuffle over Gardasil, as you may recall. And there's recommendations that young girls receive Gardasil so as to avoid cervical cancer later on in life.
I thought he was getting a payment.
He was going to make it mandatory.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Mandatory for every female.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So what was kind of invisible in all that is that men, too, right, are susceptible to infection by HPV. And particularly the medical community has recently become more aware of gay men and the connection of HPV and anal cancer, which is the kind of triangle of things that our guest who's coming on Friday is going to speak about. His name is Professor Steve Epstein. He is a sociologist now at Northwestern University, who actually has a really long history of doing good work looking at the way that LGBT communities have been thought about by medical communities as a whole. I don't know if y'all are aware, one of his first pieces that he worked on was a book back in 1996 where he talked about how AIDS grassroots activists really changed the way that research protocols work and inserted the voice of the people for whom these drugs were being designed into the research process itself, something which had not really been the case before. And Steven Epstein documented a lot of that and made a real big splash and a big name for himself. The book that he's most recently written in 2007 is a follow-up to that. And what he's looking at is the way that medical communities have continued to imagine social difference among people. Right? So you may be aware of some of the things where people have been trying to tailor medicine to specific people, like we're going to take your DNA and we're going to match this therapy precisely to your body. This is a kind of reaction against some of this, oh, there's a generic human being that we could test medicines on, and this would be good for everybody, right? So there's these two big poles, the generic human being, and then we're going to tailor it just for you. What Epstein has been noticing is that there's a middle ground, too, that's been recently more and more articulated, particularly about race, women, and more recently about sexual orientation and gender identity as well. So what would it mean to say these drugs work better for African Americans than they do for somebody else, or these therapies work better for gay men than they do for somebody else? He's really trying to unpack that and how the way that these social identities start to circulate in medical communities and the way that doctors think about their patients. Do they think about gay men as, oh, you might actually be a good person to talk with about HPV, rather than just the young girls who come into their practice, right? So that's the purpose of his talk this Friday, which is going to be at Rice University's Baker Institute at 5:30 in the afternoon.
Can anybody go?
It is free and open to the public. All that we request, because seating is limited in the venue that we have, is that you RSVP ahead of time.
And how... Well, do they contact you, or how does that work?
There are two great ways to do it. If you wanted to do it by phone, you could call the number that I'm about to say, 713-348-2162. Again, that number is 713-348-2162. That's the number for the Center for the Study of Women, Gender, and Sexuality, and we'll be glad to RSVP for you. Or you could do a quick Google search for Baker Institute events, and then you can register through their website for the event, free and open to the public.
Now, Brian, what is your role at Rice? What do you do there?
I'm a little bit of an odd animal, actually. I'm part staff, part faculty, so kind of a hybrid, if you will. As the projects coordinator, I coordinate events like this and help bring awareness to the community of the events that we do. We have a year-long research series, of which the Steve Epstein talk this Friday is part. And at the same time, I also teach the Introduction to Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgender Studies, for which Jennifer Renee Poole has been interviewed in our community research project.
And I've had the opportunity to speak to your class many times.
On many occasions. And which I hope that will happen again.
All I need is an invitation.
I think that can be arranged.
And then I guess in your spare time, you're working on the Houston Arch project.
Yeah. For those who haven't heard about Houston Arch, thank you, Brian, for bringing it up. It's the Houston Area Rainbow Collective History. It's a consortium of five organizations: the University of Houston, Rice University, the Gulf Coast Archive and Museum, the Charles Botts Collection that's housed at Resurrection Metropolitan Community Church, and the archive held by the Transgender Foundation of America. All five of these organizations got together to form ARCH because they realized that there's a ton of good historical stuff, books, magazines, leather vests, sashes, posters.
Feather boas,
indeed, drag outfits galore that not a lot of people have access to. So one of the best things that we could do is try to improve access to the resources that already exist by organizing them and making them digitally available. That's the goal of Houston Arch, which is a project of partially the Center for the Study of Women, Gender, and Sexuality at Rice.
Well, yay, Rice. Now, tell us more about this forum and what can people expect?
Well, what's going to happen this Friday at 5:30, there will be about an hour-long talk with a Q&A session where Professor Epstein will talk about the way that gay men have become imagined as a population vulnerable to human papillomavirus by the medical community. He's also going to look at the pros and cons of exactly how this medical imagination takes place. It's great, yes, that the medical communities are trying to be aware of things that maybe lesbians, gay men, bisexuals, transgender folk might be susceptible to more so than the general population. At the same time, this risks kind of falling back into a, oh, well, this class of people is somehow naturally, medically susceptible rather than socially made so. Right. Mm. So it's a question of, is there something deep and dark and secret inside of our bodies that if it's discovered by medicine, oh, maybe we could cure something? Maybe hopefully not our gender expressions or our sexual orientations. We thought we were over that.
Yeah. But isn't anal cancer throughout the population?
Indeed so.
So it's not something that's just the community, the GLBT community, but it's everyone. The general community is subject to it.
HPV is contracted through skin-to-skin contact, so you need not actually have sex. It's possible to not and still get it. Mm-hmm. It's rather prevalent in the human population, right? I don't know the exact numbers, but I remember something about like a fifth of the human population has been exposed to HPV at some point in their lives. So if you think about it like that, just saying, oh, only young girls and only gay men are susceptible is a little bit short of the mark.
But about what our current governor was thinking, but a little short on thought. My concern is that not enough people are really getting the message. And so this is part of it to get the message out that there's a vaccine.
True.
For HPV. But also this is to get inform anyone there. How many can participate in this on Friday?
The Kelly International Conference Facility is the venue where we'll be holding the talk, and it holds 140 people. And we do have the capacity for people to listen in remotely if we exceed that by having people outside in the Dore Commons at the Baker Institute.
Other than general population, who should come? Who really needs to come listen to this?
Well, it's interesting because what we've been trying to do is to forge a really broad community to be in the audience. We've been reaching out to the medical center, MD Anderson, Memorial Hermann, Baylor. We've been reaching out to the political community to make sure that they're aware of this because it's a public policy issue as well.
Yes, it is.
Who has access to treatment? Who has access to information? And who funds that? Those are the kinds of decisions of which policymakers need to be aware and informed, right? We've also been reaching out to the LGBT community, like here in our wonderful hallowed queer voices. We've also had a little time with After Hours. Outsmart was kind enough to run something for us as well. The other important part, too, is the academic community, because I think that one of the things that makes this conversation really rich is having all of those different components come together and be part of the conversation, because it's not just Professor Epstein who's going to be up there talking. There's a Q&A afterwards, and I think the quality of the conversation is only as good as the questions people bring to it. And the more diverse crowd you have for that, the better conversation it's going to be.
Very good. We've been talking to Brian Riedel of Rice University, who is hosting, Rice is hosting a forum this Friday
at 5:30 p.m. There will be a 6:30 reception. The location is the Baker Institute on the Rice University campus. There's convenient parking next door in the central campus garage. For more information about the event, to register for the event, though it is free and open to the public, you can call 713-348-2162. Again, that number is 713 248-2162, or you can Google Baker Institute Events, find their webpage, and register for Professor Steve Epstein's talk.
Well, Brian, is there anything else you want our listeners to know about the forum?
Well, I think the most important part of it is to come and see, because he's really on the cutting edge, and to have some of the people who we know are coming from the medical community there to hear what he's going to say, it'd be really good for people who are care about public policy, who care about LGBT representation in medicine, who care about their own personal health, or maybe there's someone that they know who might have been diagnosed with cervical cancer or with anal cancer. This would be information valuable to a lot of people.
Very good.
Thank you very much. We appreciate you coming. And for all of you out there, please, the seating is limited, so make your reservation and RSVP to be part of it.
Thank you so much.
And as always, thank you very much, Brian.
It's a pleasure to be here.
This is Queer Voices.
Thank you.
London Gay Men's Chorus there from 1998. That's a private label recording, and the name of the song, Gimme, Gimme, Gimme. And by the way, you can follow along with everything that we're doing here at Queer Voices on Twitter, because Summer is sitting here next to me twittering away on the computer and tweeting away. See, it's old and square thing. Okay, we're tweeting, and she's tapping on the keyboard, and we also have a Facebook page, and we have a web page, and so we're totally connected, as well as broadcasting.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Belinsky and the entire Queer Voices crew.
This way.
Paul Hidalgo is here with us to talk about his favorite pastime, or actually, it's your full time what you do. Let's explain this to our audience.
Okay, I'm here on behalf of the Spay Neuter Assistance Program, SNAP, and a special program we have, the Animal Aid Program, which is to assist people living with HIV and AIDS, care for their dogs and cats, because we all love our animals. We have a special program that provides 40% discount on wellness care and also free spay neuter surgery to those affected by this ailment.
Well, that's really great. That's a real reach-out program.
Yeah, we work with lots of community organizations to get out there to people who need it. And one special thing we do for it is we have a yearly fundraiser that started 3 years ago called Miss Perfect that the gay community puts on.
That's with the lots of R's.
Yes, it is.
Well, actually, before we get into the fundraiser, let's talk a little bit why animals are so special to people dealing with AIDS.
It's been shown in study after study that anyone suffering from any type of illness, that the love and the unconditional love of an animal can help them tremendously emotionally and also physically. And sadly, the tremendous costs of living with HIV and AIDS can put a damper on someone's financials to where they can't provide the proper care for their beloved four-legged family members. So SNAP saw this need, and we reached out to other organizations within the HIV/AIDS community, and through various partnerships, we were able to offer this service to the community.
That's really fabulous.
That is. Because how important. I know how my two fur people are with me when I, you know, just with a cold. And I can only imagine how important it is for someone suffering from HIV. The event you have is a fundraiser, correct?
Yes.
And this is for SNAP. And tell us a little bit about SNAP.
SNAP, we are an organization, we've been in the Houston area for many years now, providing spay-neuter surgery for the general public. Our main goal is to prevent animal overpopulation. We have
and that's a big problem here, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It is. There's lots of homeless animals. So to prevent homeless animals, we offer free spay-neuter surgery to low-income people with our mobile truck that operates here in Houston. We also have one in San Antonio. And we just opened up our brand-new surgery clinic here off of Durham and I-10 that offers low-cost spay-neuter surgery to the general public to make it accessible to everyone.
And that's wonderful. I was also involved in a volunteer effort on to capture feral cats, which is, you know, one pair of cats produces in 2 years or 1 year something an enormous amount. 20,000-30,000 animals will be born out of just one pair, and so the wild cats, the feral cats, being captured and brought in to be spayed
and
neutered.
And we offer feral cat spay neuters. You don't need an appointment. You can just bring them into our clinic, and we'll get them taken care of. Because once you catch a feral once, you'll probably never catch it again.
First thing. Well, tell us about the fundraiser.
The fundraiser is set to take place this Saturday at TC's Bar, which is 817 Fairview. It started 3 years ago as just kind of something I wanted to get involved in drag, and I saw these pageants and these extravagant events, and in my little mind, I thought, well, why can't I throw one together? And the first year was very, very small. We only had two contestants, and Vivica Perry won, who was a godsend for me, because the next year she helped me make it into a real full-fledged pageant. And last year we raised $1,200 for this program. Every dollar goes straight into the AAP program to assist these people and their animals. And Regine this year has taken the wings of the event, and she's really making it her event this year. And she could probably tell you more about what she sees
this year. More importantly, tell me how you organize drag queens.
Well, that is like herding cats.
That's an art.
That is an art in itself, because we have what we call drag time and normal time. And so drag time is usually an hour later. So yeah. It's kind of hard.
Oh, I do know that one.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to organize it. But when you get girls together that are willing to work and to show up on time and to do what needs to be done, it's not very hard at all. As long as they've got the compassion to, you know, contribute to our organization and what we're trying to do, then, you know, we never really have a problem with it.
Well, and I'm not sure the younger generation completely understands how much drag queens have contributed to this community.
Yeah, I don't think they do either.
And, you know, we joke about how it is hard to organize them, but the reality is the heart of gold that all of them have to do such wonderful work, and in fact, especially during the height of the AIDS crisis, how we probably wouldn't been able to pull through between the women who helped care for us and for the drag queens who helped raise money and deal with the situation and try to make us laugh sometimes.
Yeah, that was my whole deal with wanting to compete and do the fundraiser when I met Paul and Vivica and them, because it's very close to me. You know, my other half is HIV positive. So, you know, being in a relationship with someone who is HIV positive, and I've got friends that I've lost to the disease and friends that are still living with it, and anything that I can do to help, or anything that I can do to contribute to it, I try my best. I don't care if I'm dog tired, I'll still try to do my best to do what I can to help out. And that's why I was so excited when they told me about the whole program, because it is true. People do depend a lot on their pets, and especially if they live at home alone and it's just them, they need that companionship, and sometimes they're not able to afford the care that they need to get for their pets. So this SNAP organization is a godsend. It really is.
Well, the importance of the, in a follow-up with what Jack said, of the drag community has always been that way. I remember in my early days, but while I was still closeted, that was where I was going to all those events and to donate money. Because there seemed to be, every weekend, there was some kind of fundraiser for HIV or some other organization within our community that needed help.
Yes.
You know, and then it's just a wonderful thing that you do. And you know, I admire Paul for getting out there and doing it. SNAP's a great organization. I recommend it to a lot of people whom I know individually. They couldn't get their cat neutered or spayed. And I said, look, take it to SNAP. You know, sometimes, in one case, even drove them down there for an appointment. And it's something you really do, and it contributes to them. So where's the location again? And I don't know where that is.
It's at 1801 Durham. It's on Durham and I-10. It's actually facing I-10 right when you exit Durham. We actually combined our former surgery clinic and our wellness clinic to create a new clinic that is twice the size of both clinics combined. So we will now be able to serve more animals in the Houston area than ever before.
A nice strip center.
It's in a strip. Now I know where it is. Yeah, that's the wellness center. I know where that is.
Good. So tell us a little bit about exactly what is the event.
Miss Perfect is, how can I put this? It's glamour. The more glam, I think, the better. I mean, it's a way for us to use our artistry and our entertainment to bring people in and to help raise money. Because most girls do pageants, they want to spend money on it, spend money, and it's all about what you win. This way, you win because you get to help. And so, this year, this pageant is going to be bigger than it was last year. I think we had, six contestants last year when I competed. And this year, I'm hoping for at least eight. Because I've had just mounds of girls asking, well, where is it? When is it going to be? You know, is there an entry fee? And I'm trying to encourage each girl that wants to come and compete to just get a hold of either me or Paul. And it's going to be Saturday the 6th. It starts at
7:30
at TC's.
Is that real 7:30?
Yes, real 7:30.
That's
okay. 7:30 normal time.
Okay.
And about probably 8:30 drag time.
Okay. All right. Just checking on that. Just want to make sure if you come out there. What can we expect to see? What are the events in the competition?
Well, the categories consist of talent, question and answer, evening gown, and
presentation
is just a category that just to present yourself, to let the audience know who you are and who and why you're competing. Talent is whatever talent you may have. If you can sing, if you can dance, if you can lip sync, if you can play the spoons or whatever you can do, that will be considered your talent. And evening gown, which is what I like the most, is because you get to wear all kinds of body jewelry. It's going to be a fabulous, fabulous event. I'm really hoping that everybody enjoys it. I kind of picked a theme this year as the glamorous life, so there's going to be the glamorous life in faux fur. So there's probably going to be a lot of fake furs and rhinestones everywhere. So if you are a fan of bling bling, come out and see us this Saturday at TC's.
And good drag shows.
Good drag
shows. Yes, absolutely. And don't forget to bring a few dollars to contribute.
Yeah.
This is for a good cause.
That's
the thing to remember.
We must not forget that this is a fundraiser. So, yes, whatever you can bring and however you can help, we will be greatly appreciated.
If anybody's listening and wants to participate, how do they get in touch with you? Where do they get in touch with you?
You can reach me either at myspace.com/RegineSimone, or you can email me at ericcraigsimon@aol.com, and I can give you all the information. And I believe Paul...
They can call me anytime at 713-516-8950, or they can email me at phidalgo25@gmail.com.
What I liked is the fact that this is listed on the SNAP website.
Total,
no problem. This is a drag show. This is what we're doing. We're very open about it.
And that I think that's what people like about it, because, you know, there's no hidden agenda. Everybody knows what they are going to get, you know. There's not, come out for a fundraiser, and then, bam, there's a bunch of drag queens, you know. So this way they know it's a drag show, and it's in a pageant format, so you will get your money's worth. You'll have a fabulous time. Fabulous, fabulous time.
And this event's a lot of fun for us because, you know, as drag entertainers, we get to, you know, put on shows for the gay community all the time. But SNAP is not a gay organization in the least bit. So we have a lot of straight people who come to this show and really get to see drag for the first time.
And I think they enjoy it more than the regular crowd does. I do it, you know, I work for a living. I work at JR's as an entertainer over there. So I'm constantly in drag, and you know, we don't get as much response from our crowd than we get from the straight crowd. I mean, they just love it to death. I mean, you can do some of the best songs you've ever heard, and they would think that you just hung the moon. So yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Well, great. We have this information on our website, queervoices.org, and you can have all the contact information. So it's this Saturday starting at 7:30?
Yes, it is.
7:30 at, where's the venue?
817 Fairview, TC's Bar.
Great. And we thank you both for coming out and supporting SNAP and supporting people who really need help in keeping their animals, which helped them out a lot.
Thank you so much
for having me.
You're listening to Queer Voices.
The hearts and minds of the world go out to those impacted by the devastation in Haiti. KPFT, your community radio station, encourages you to do what you can to support efforts to help others in the wake of this tragedy. Around the world, people like you are lending assistance. For example, Partners in Health, an international organization providing health care for the poor, is seeking contributions for medical help for Haitians. Visit standwithhaiti.com to learn more about how you can help. Please stay tuned for ongoing coverage of the crisis in Haiti right here on 90.1 KPFT, including on the BBC News at 7 a.m., on Democracy Now! At 8, and Free Speech Radio News at 4 p.m. Keep listening to KPFT to learn more about aid organizations and how you can support them, and the radio station that provides you up-to-the-minute coverage. Keep the people of Haiti in your thoughts. Thank you for listening to KPFT Houston.
Pacifica is listener-sponsored radio. What does that mean?
Listener sponsorship is an answer to the practical problem of getting better radio programs and keeping them.
A focus on advertisers or the mass audience accounts for the mediocrity of corporate radio.
When listeners support the radio they enjoy, their choices become better.
Listener sponsorship takes control of your radio out of the hands of companies and into the hands of the community.
But maintaining this sort of radio requires you.
Your pledge of support keeps KPFT on the air as a vital community resource.
So call our membership department at 713-526-4000, extension 314, to become a member today. You can even go online at kpft.org to make your pledge.
Your pledge is essential to keep listener sponsorship viable for generations to come.
So call 713-526-4000 to support KPFT.
This is commercial-free listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio.
KPFT, Houston.
When you tune in to KPFT, you notice something right away. No ads.
KPFT is a non-commercial radio station. We don't accept advertising or underwriting from businesses, nor does KPFT receive payment for any program we air.
KPFT further disallows product plug-in or endorsements.
We do this because you, the listener, deserve access to the radio you love, without all the commercials, taglines, and cross-promotion that corporate radio subjects you to. If you ever hear something on KPFT that you have concerns about, contact our program director at 713-526-4000.
If you enjoy this kind of option on Houston's airwaves, become a member.
KPFT is able to stay commercial-free because listeners like you make a pledge of support to keep us on the air. Your pledge is important.
Call our membership department at 713-526-4000 or visit kpft.org.
That's 713-526-4000 or kpft.org to become a member. This is commercial-free, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio. KPFT, Houston.
This is Queer Voices.
A song called What Do You Want From Me from an album called For Your Entertainment from 2009. And then before that, Rachel Sage with Chandelier, and that was from 2008. And I'd like to thank J.D. Doyle for providing the music that we use on our show. And you can look at more of what J.D. has to offer at queermusicheritage.com. This is Queer Voices.
And this is Brian Livington.
And Jennifer Renee.
And recently in our community, there's been a lot of focus and spotlight on transgendered issues, especially with the murder of someone in our own community and the vigil that we held last week. And
yes, last Monday before our show.
And in the studio tonight, we have the director of the Houston Transgender Foundation, Kristen Williams. Welcome to the show.
Hi, it's good to be back.
Yes. Now, just briefly, we talked about that. We had a chance to talk last week, right after, because after the vigil, I came over to the studio and got on Interchange and talked about it. So we had
excellent.
Some good coverage of the event and all. But why don't you tell me a little bit about what the event was for those out in the audience that may have missed it or didn't know anything about it?
Sure. Okay. So this event was about Myra Eichel. And she was a trans woman here in Houston, and she died a horrendous death. She was beaten nearly to death and then strangled. And when the murder was reported through HPD's public relations department, they made a point of noting that the area where she was found is noted for prostitution and drug use and homelessness, and the media picked up on that and kind of ran with it, you know, mm-hmm. transvestite found, you know, an area known for prostitution, and, you know, off it went, you know, and, you know, it was the same old song and dance. This poor woman had been horrendously murdered. You know, not just a simple shot to the head. This took a long time. And she suffered horribly. And then after she had been murdered, the press just went to town slandering her. Yeah. Well, afterwards, it turned out, I confirmed with HPD, that prostitution, drugs, homelessness, none of that was a factor in this crime at all.
Mm-hmm.
And that she worked as a cleaning woman, she had her own place, They failed to mention that that area that supposedly a place that is known for drugs and prostitution is also just down from the Wheeler Street bus and train station. It's also just a few blocks away from the City of Houston mayor's home. Mm-hmm. You know, there were so many ways to characterize this area, but of course the one that was picked was the seemingly most sensational, and that was what was played up. And so when that happened, the community organized and started to speak out about the way the media was choosing to report Myra's death and her life. Mm-hmm. And in that, we were going to organize a vigil. Now, we were expecting 25, 30, you know, we were hoping, crossing our fingers, for maybe 40 people. You know, we were thinking that that was going to be a big thing, if we could get 40 people there. What happened was that we had a few hundred people show up.
Uh-huh.
The event was really quite large. It went way beyond anything that I could have expected. And the people who came there, they came there with their children and their mothers and siblings, and the gay, lesbian, bi, trans, questioning, genderqueer, straight. Everyone came out for this woman, and to stand there in solidarity with the trans community to say, you know, look, whenever things like this happen, the media has a responsibility to report correctly and not to sink and slanderize, sink to the level of Jerry Springer and slanderize you know, a woman's memory, just for, what is that saying in media? If it bleeds, it leads.
That's exactly right.
Right. And so, practically every media outlet in Houston also covered, Myra's, vigil. From TV to Spanish language media to radio, print media, it was really, really, really incredible. And I can't stress how amazing that was to stand there, and when we lit the candles and everyone bowed their heads and gave a moment of silence to honor this transgender woman, to honor her loss, and to stand there in solidarity with the transgender community. It was amazing. It was an amazing moment. It was certainly sad, but in all, also in that sense of solidarity, just such a beautiful moment also.
Now, well, we've seen a struggle with our community, because you and I both transgender, is the fact that the awareness of our community, that we actually exist, it was a struggle for many years to be accepted as part of the gay and lesbian community.
Sure.
And a number of organizations finally changing their names or putting in their inclusive mission statements, trans people included in that. So it's been a struggle. This was the vigil of so many was absolutely amazing. I would not have anticipated that many people coming out. Now, we talked, via electronically, you know, the Facebook and emails and constant conversation about the way what I call the journalistic laziness on the part of the media,
exactly,
who did not take the time to really research a story. They just sort of led with whatever was on the police blotter
at the time.
And didn't follow any of the guidelines that have been accepted. Now,
absolutely,
talk about those guidelines so that people understand what we're talking about.
Right. Okay. So the industry has set guidelines for reporting issues affecting the transgender community. The AP, the New York Times, and certainly the GLAAD has its own media resource guide. And what these guides do is whenever there's a subject, say a transgender person, it helps the reporter understand how to report, what kind of language to best convey the news in an appropriate and sensitive yet direct and honest fashion. And for Myra, all of those guidebooks, everything was kind of tossed out the window in favor of this Jerry Springer type reporting.
Well, journalistic laziness, because yes. we had the Chronicle print something, and I've forgotten now, there were only two of the electronic media that really did it wrong.
Well, yes, Houston Press, their initial report was really quite atrocious. I mean, really, really offensive. Mm-hmm. They went as far as to claim that Myra had tricked the police, you know, and just really, whenever I read in the Houston Press, you know, what they were saying, my jaw literally dropped.
Tabloid journalism.
Yes, absolutely. I believe one of the 13 and Channel 2 did an initial story as well, and of course used all the incorrect pronouns, referred to her as a man, referred to her using the name that she was not known by, and I think that it's correct that they just looked at what the police statement was, went by that, and didn't bother to check the media standards.
Well, and which goes to say the beauty of what happened was that enough people came out and enough attention was brought to it that all the media outlets that could make it were there.
Absolutely.
To get it right,
yeah,
about who she was, and that was important.
Yeah, it was very, very important. I think that was a turning point in Houston, because I think, you know, God forbid, but the next time something like this happens, or even some report on the transgender community, some event or something, I think that they will pull out their guidebooks and you know, look at that and use it. And I think that the media will be more sensitive about how they report things because of this, you know, frankly, large community outcry against the way that Myra was treated in the media.
Yeah. To move along on our subject, because
sure.
I want to cover the Transgender Foundation of America and the Transgender Center here in Houston. Tell us something about that.
Okay, well, the Transgender Foundation of America is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, and the mission statement is really, really simple. We're here to help improve the lives of transgender people. That's what we do. And so our activities are really eclectic. You know, everything from having an archive, possibly one of the largest transgender archives around, covering all kinds of, cultures going back thousands of years, to direct HIV care and prevention and counseling and therapy support and all of these kinds of direct services for people who are transgender. Mm-hmm. And of course, on top of that, there's all the referrals and support groups and all of those kinds of things too.
Did you have something, Brian?
Well, I wanted to, before we got off into the transgender thing, I wanted to talk about the nature of the crime that happened during the day.
Mm.
And have we heard anything from the HPD? Is there any leads?
Well, and again, even if nothing else happened because of the vigil, if this one single thing was it would have been enough. So there was the name of an individual who surfaced, who had intimate knowledge of the murder itself. This this individual goes by the name of Laos Jack, and he had some kind of detailed information about why she was perhaps murdered and in what fashion, and no one's seen him since. And all of that information was given to HPD. Now, what's come of that, I don't know.
Has the DA's office looked at this as a hate crime?
Well, okay, so that's a really complex question.
Okay,
I mean, if the killer were to admit that they saw her and identified her as being transgender and therefore attacked her, or if she was in the process of being murdered and someone walked by and heard a lot of slanderous language, or had he spray painted something on the wall slanderous, then that's possible. But even if all of that happened, it's important to remember that transgender people are explicitly excluded from the Janesburg hate crimes bill.
Well, that's why I wanted to say that. One other thing that came out of this, and not out of what happened to Myra and all, but you were the recipient of the Jenny Jones, Jenny's Heroes grant.
Right, right.
And tell me about that.
Okay, well,
congratulations.
Oh, well, thanks. It's really kind of a grant to help organizations, people support causes, and what she's doing is helping us expand our library to the tune of $5,000 worth of books. So we're really glad about that. That's wonderful. Also Dell Computers just recently gave us a grant too. It was really kind of strange and almost surrealistic to get this call from Jenny Jones saying, "Hey, we've decided that you're a hero."
That's
and
crazy.
We're going to, yeah, that was really out there, but I was certainly jazzed and happy to hear about that.
Congratulations on that.
Thanks.
Give us the information on how to contact the foundation and any other resources.
Sure. The phone number is 713-520-8586. Again, that's 713-520-8586. You can also reach us online at tgctr.org.
All right, thank you. We've been talking with Kristen Williams, director of the Transgender Foundation of America here in Houston. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks.
And the T is no longer silent in GLBT.
That's right. And this is Queer Voices.
Hitch your rig to the nearest post and set a spell for a story about rural queer life, American history, and the silver screen later in the program. When the President of the United States mentions your cause in the annual State of the Union address, it's a notable occasion. Bill Clinton was the first to bring up LGBT issues. That was in 1999, 6 years after he had established the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy on gay and lesbian military personnel. In his first State of the Union speech, President Barack Obama vowed to end that policy.
We find unity in our incredible diversity, drawing on the promise enshrined in our Constitution. The notion that we're all created equal, that no matter who you are or what you look like, if you abide by the law, you should be protected by it. If you adhere to our common values, you should be treated no different than anyone else. We must continually renew this promise. My administration has a civil rights division that is once again prosecuting civil rights violations and employment discrimination. We finally strengthened. We finally strengthened our laws to protect against crimes driven by hate. This year, I will work with Congress and our military to finally repeal the law that denies gay Americans the right to serve the country they love because of who they are. It's the right thing to do.
Obama's oft-repeated promise to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell left many LGBT activists cold. Critics are pointing out that the commitment came once again without a timeline or a concrete plan of action. Several also note that the president did not offer to block the witch hunts and dismissal of service members that continue until the policy can be changed. The State of the Union address was followed by an announcement that Defense Secretary Robert Gates and Joint Chiefs of Staff Chair Admiral Michael Mullen will be testifying about the military budget this week before the Senate Armed Services Committee and at another hearing specifically on Don't Ask, Don't Tell later this month. However, Pentagon sources have told the press that there is no firm plan for implementing a repeal of the policy at this time. That doesn't satisfy LGBT leaders like National Gay and Lesbian Task Force Executive Director Rhea Carey, who called Don't Ask, Don't Tell unnecessary, unfair, and immoral. Her post-State of the Union statement demanded that the federal government place fairness above foot-dragging because, she said, it is a disgrace that patriotic service members are still being discharged under the president's watch.
A new This Way Out update has been posted on our website. For recent programming information and behind-the-scenes news about your favorite international LGBT radio show, log on to www.thiswayout.org.
A lonesome cowboy caresses a pair of shirts near the end of the film Brokeback Mountain. Where are those shirts now? They're hanging in the Gene Autry Museum of Western Heritage in Los Angeles. How they got there is just part of the compelling campfire tale spun by This Way Out's Steve Pride.
Oh, a cowboy needs a horse, needs a horse, needs a horse, and he's gotta have a rope, have a rope, have a rope, and he oughta have a song, have a song, have a song, if he wants to keep riding, riding.
Hello, my name is Gregory Hinton. I'm an author and a filmmaker. I've written four novels, Cathedral City, Desperate Hearts, The Way Things Ought to Be, and Santa Monica Canyon. I also produced and wrote Circuit and the feature film It's My Party for MGM. A year ago, I was researching a book about my own childhood in Wyoming, and I got acquainted with the Autry, and the Autry has a very extensive Western film gallery. So I was walking through it, and, you know, you see the films all the way from Roy Rogers to Clint Eastwood and Gary Cooper and John Wayne. And I stopped because I thought something was missing, and I noticed that there was no reference to Brokeback Mountain, which deserved to be in the gallery for three reasons. One, it was a very successful Western. Two, it was a critically acclaimed Western. And three, it was a seminal Western. And I went home and I asked my partner, I said, whatever happened to those shirts from Brokeback Mountain?
Diana Asana co-wrote the screenplay to Brokeback Mountain with Larry McMultry, basing it on the Annie Proulx short story.
She was in a bar one night and saw this older gentleman sort of standing to the back, watching these young guys play pool, and it wasn't that he was looking at them with so much as desire or anything like that, but she said she wondered if he weren't country gay. And it just sort of, you know, he was of an age, and she began to count backwards to where he would have been a young man in her mind, and it would have been in the early 60s, and then it just, her imagination just took off.
At the north end of the closet, a tiny jog in the wall made a slight hiding place, and here, stiff with long suspension from a nail, hung a shirt.
Actor Campbell Scott, reading from the story by Annie Prue.
He lifted it off the nail. Jack's old shirt from Brokeback days. The dried blood on the sleeve was his own blood, a gushing nosebleed on the last afternoon on the mountain, when Jack, in their contortionistic grappling and wrestling, had slammed Ennis's nose hard with his knee. He had staunched the blood, which was everywhere, all over both of them, with his shirt sleeve. But the staunching hadn't held because Ennis had suddenly swung from the deck and laid the ministering angel out in the wild columbine, wings folded. The shirt seemed heavy until he saw there was another shirt inside it, the sleeves carefully worked down inside Jack's sleeves. It was his own plaid shirt, lost, he'd thought, long ago in some damn laundry. His dirty shirt, the pocket ripped, buttons missing, stolen by Jack and hidden here inside Jack's own shirt, the pair like two skins, one inside the other, two in one. He pressed his face into the fabric and breathed in slowly through his mouth and nose, hoping for the faintest smoke and mountain sage and salty, sweet stink of Jack. But there was no real scent, only the memory of it, the imagined power of Brokeback Mountain, of which nothing was left but what he held in his hands.
Those shirts from Brokeback Mountain, they had been sold at a charity auction for $100,000, and they were purchased by a memorabilia collector named Tom Gregory. And I sent him an email on a generic web address on his website, and I said, I understand that you own the shirts from Brokeback Mountain, and I think that they belong in a museum. Do you mind if I work that out? And he said, you know, I have to say, when I bought the shirts, I kind of thought I'd be hearing from major museums all over the world, and I'm embarrassed to admit this, but you're the first person who called me. He said, and my feelings were kind of hurt, not for me, but for the shirts, for what they represent. A year later, the Brokeback shirts are hanging in the Western Contemporary case in the Autry Museum. They went from being shirts to props to pop icons, and now they're genuine artifacts. And 70,000 children go through the Autry every year, and you walk through the film gallery, and it's a whole survey of the Western film genre, and it ends with Brokeback Mountain. It's important because the Autry is part of a symposium called Museums West. There are 12 Western art museums in the United States, and they are all dedicated to preserving the history and culture of the American West. The Autry has agreed not only to display the Brokeback shirts, they've also just received the archives from the International Gay Rodeo Association, which I also arranged for, and they're now in their permanent rodeo collection in the Autry Library, which is major because, again, there's nothing about gay rodeo in any of these other museums and their research libraries. So the Autry is first, and they really deserve our appreciation for doing this.
And why does Brokeback resonate so deeply with Gregory Hinton?
I was born on the Fort Peck Indian Reservation in northeastern Montana, and then as a kid moved to Cody, Wyoming. So I am a gay man from the rural West, as was my gay brother. My dad was a small-town newspaper editor. He was the editor of the Cody Enterprise in 1956 to 62, which was originally founded by Buffalo Bill. And our childhood was Yellowstone Park. It was rodeo every night and every weekend in the summer. We had really a true Wild West childhood. Wyoming has changed the least of all of the Western states, and it was wonderful. And my dad was very, very busy. He had to work 18 hours a day. I mean, he did everything for the newspaper. But we were a close family, and my brother and I both came out at the same time in 1975, and it was a shock to my folks, but they circled the wagons, is what I like to say, and my dad became a new father to us both. when this happened. He went through all of the guilt and all of that, thinking it was his fault because he'd been so busy when we were little. And of course it wasn't, but my dad loved us, and what he said at the time was better two than one, because he thought we would always have each other to take care of. And that's why the intertwined shirts in Brokeback Mountain, one hanging on top of the other on the single hanger, reminds me of what my dad had said, two better than one, so that we would always have each other.
What if you and me had a little ranch somewhere, a little cow and calf operation? Be sweet life. And hell, Lorraine's old man, you better give me a down payment to get lost. I mean, he more or less already said it.
No, I told you it ain't gonna be that way. You know, you got your wife and baby in Texas, and you know, I got my life in Riverton.
That's so. You and Alma, that's a lie.
Oh, you shut up about Alma. This ain't her fault. The bottom line is, we're around each other, and this thing grabs hold of us again in the wrong place, in the wrong time, and we're dead.
I think that what Brokeback Mountain doesn't do is it doesn't show the options that were available to Ennis Delmar and Jack Twist. There were and still are many LGBTs who live in rural Western areas who did, quote, gut up and either leave their communities behind and go to the cities, or they stayed and kind of they made do. But Brokeback didn't provide the options that were available that many of us had already sought out. But unfortunately, what it would have taken would be to leave home. And the most important thing for me about Out West at the Autry is it's a celebration of our GLBT Western history. But not only that, it's an acknowledgement that the West belongs to everybody, and that our rural communities, when we leave them behind, are the worse off for the loss of us. And it's very important just to acknowledge that in Montana and in Wyoming and in Idaho and in Washington State and the other states, there are thriving LGBT communities who are living their lives without even some of the civil rights that we take for granted, but they've stayed because they love the country. And that's what I hope to acknowledge with Out West.
Before Brokeback Mountain changed film history, I had a chance to ask its young star about the character he played.
What did I like about Ennis? I don't know. His potential. He had great potential to love, and I think the one time you really see the potential is with his kids, his children, because that's the one form of love he's really allowed to express. It's not dangerous to him. And with his wife, it just wasn't really love. It was what he thought should be love, and it was a routine that he slipped into because it was conventional, it was traditional, and obviously his love for Jack was forbidden, and he hated himself for it. He punished himself for it. Essentially, he was a homophobic man in love with another man, and I guess I always had faith in the love within him a lot more than he did, and I think that's what all the characters I think found in him too, was this the potential within this masculine figure to be kind of vulnerable.
What do I think happened to Ennis Delmar after he hung those shirts back up in his trailer? He had a supportive daughter who was coming back into his life, and I just hope that he sought companionship and just didn't stay in the prison of his self-loathing and denial. I hope he went south to Denver or found a friend to join him in his trailer up in Riverton.
He was a friend of mine. Was a friend of mine.
The Gene Autry Western Museum is located in Los Angeles on the edge of Griffith Park. My thanks to Gregory Hinton, Diana Asana, and of course, the late Heath Ledger. I'm Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
Every time I hear his name, Lord, I just can't keep from crying. 'Cause he was a friend of mine.
Thanks for tuning into This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. This week, Chris Wilson, John Torres, Sherry Lunn, and Steve Pride contributed program material. Chocolate Milk and Willie Nelson performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out is only made possible by our listeners. Thank you. Log on to thiswayout.org to see how you can support our work, listen to our podcasts, read the text of this week's news wrap, or subscribe to CDs of our programs. To receive our weekly program email alert, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on KHSU Arcata, California, 2BBB Bellingen, New South Wales, WPKN Bridgeport, Connecticut, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
This Way Out is heard every week as part of Queer Voices. You are listening to 90.1 FM KPFT.
We want to thank our guests tonight, starting out with David Elliott.
And Brian Riddell came from Rice University. And we
had somebody before that, though, right?
Yes, we did. We had Mercury
Rich.
Rick Aaronshield.
I was trying to figure out. Thank you. I wasn't even going to try to mention it.
And then after Brian Riddell, we had Paul Hidalgo.
And then Kristen Williams, director of the Transgender Foundation of America.
And if you'd like more information, go to our website, queervoices.org, and we'll see you next week.
Thank you.
Good night.
You have been listening to Queer Voices. Heard each Monday at 9 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Network station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Valensky. On-air voices are Glenn Holt, J.D. Doyle, Brian Levinka, Jennifer Renee, and Jack Valensky, with contributing editors Joan Devlin in Iowa and David Elliott in Washington, D.C. The music heard on this program is provided by J.D. Doyle, who also contributes to the audio file segment of This Way Out and who produces Queer Music Heritage, which is an hour-long feature of Queer Voices the fourth Monday of every month. For more information, visit JD's website at queermusicheritage.com. And listen every Saturday night, Sunday morning at 1 a.m. for After Hours with Jimmy Carper. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. This is listener-sponsored and commercial-free Pacifica Radio, KPFT, at 90.1 FM, 89.5 FM Galveston, and worldwide via streaming audio from kpft.org. For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
On behalf of KPFT, thank you for your support this past year. In 2010, KPFT celebrates our 40th birthday, and we expect even greater things in this year ahead. Please take a moment to think of how much you relied on KPFT. KPFT has shared visions of a better world.
I like Love Anonymous more than Murder Incorporated, or shall we say South Africa.
There comes a time when people get tired of being trampled over by the iron feet of oppression.
And the disease of the spirit lives in the mindset.
In honor of KPFT's 40th birthday, please make a tax-deductible contribution today. Every donation helps. Visit us online at kpft.org or call 713-526-4000 to support KPFT, to shorten our on-air pledge drives, to keep us growing. We look forward to serving you throughout KPFT's 40th birthday year here in 2010, and thanks for listening to KPFT Houston. Thank you.
2010 and KPFT's 40th anniversary upon us, it's time to make good on those New Year's resolutions. Maybe you're looking to be involved in your community this year. Or maybe you want to network and make contacts or new friends. You can put your time to use by volunteering at KPFT. Here are a few opportunities. KPFT is always looking for telephone help for pledge drives. Email volunteer@kpft.org to be involved. KPFT also needs help in its music library. Email music@kpft.org to participate. Finally, our 40th anniversary event needs volunteers. Email volunteer@kpft.org to lend a hand during this historic...
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.